Everybody's being taken in by the Me Too trick, and some thoughts on freedom of speech. I'm Justin Katz, and this is Last Impressions 36. The latest explosive, yet probably minimally important story in Rhode Island right now is the story of Representative Teresa Tanzi's allegations that somebody higher up in the state house at one point told her that, quote, let me give the full quote, quote, "I have been told sexual favors would allow my bills to go further." This was reported Tuesday in the Providence Journal. This is part of the entire, this whole #MeToo thing, which from a certain perspective is designed basically to foster vague allegations and create an impression of crisis that links these vague impressions, gives somebody a statistic, a million people have retweeted this, et cetera, in order to connect every little interaction with known indiscretions and even crimes, mainly on the Harvey Weinstein episode, and to make that into a viable movement that has real effects on policies and limits and changes how people can interact and speak to each other. Apparently the Me Too hashtag itself started with Alyssa Milano, who at least to anybody of my age is going to be recognizable as Tony Danza's daughter on the sitcom Who's the Boss back in the 80s. Not to go on too much of a tangent here, some on Facebook, some of the people I went to elementary school with were asking, somebody had visited the elementary school and noticed the floor tiles and asked on Facebook, is this the color that they were before? And somebody actually produced, I had forgotten, there was I think it was High C Drinks. Some drinks commercial was filmed in our school. And so there was one shot that shows the hallway tile. And it was indeed the same tile, hasn't been changed or has been changed with an exact replica. In any event. But anyway, Alyssa Milano was in that too. So there's a very close connection right here to this Me Too hashtag to my elementary school, right? Just, you know, Kevin Bacon and the 7 degrees of separation or whatever. But anyway, the social pressure on this hashtag, this Me Too hashtag, is to chime in and offer some kind of support. Even if, no, not really Me Too. I mean, even if there's no story behind the hashtag, but it creates this pressure to find some way. I mean, so you can do the Me Too hashtag for whatever reason, just to show support. That's how hashtags are typically used. But then if you're asked about it, you know, even if you have to come up with some imagination or corrupt a relatively benign interaction in your past, I mean, everybody can come up with something to say Me Too. And this sort of a hashtag movement encourages that. And of course, as I said, everybody, if sexual harassment or assault or whatever is defined that broadly as it has been, you know, even to the point of interrupting people, you know, man spreading or any taking credit for other people's work, all of these things are tied into this sort of theme of sexual harassment, then it doesn't really belong. But if it's that broad, you know, everybody will have some sort of qualifying experience. I mean, I remember in college, I went up to ask some kind of question to a female professor in English about I think it was a Robert Frost poem or something. And she said, well, you know, I'd love to discuss it with you, or we could discuss it over coffee or something to that effect. And something in the way she said it just struck me as odd, you know, being so funny looking, I don't get propositioned all that often. But it was probably just a benign thing. I wouldn't even assume that it was a come on, but if I wanted to, if I were encouraged to come up with some evidence, social pressure encouraging me to come up with some evidence that I was involved, I had been just like everybody else and having these experiences, then I might find myself raising that one. And again, it doesn't have to be a come on, actually. I put on the Ocean State Current this week, video of Teresa Tanzi interrupting a fellow legislator during a hearing. She was just, you know, it had been a long hearing and was getting late and she wanted to get moving. And his questions probably were, you know, drawing into more detail than was possibly needed. And so, but she objected and interrupted him. Now, if you switched the genders, it would be very easy for him to say, or the she, for the female being interrupted in exactly the same way. See, that's what men do to women. But it wasn't that. So anybody can come up with some kind of qualifying experience. I mean, in the phrasing of Tansey's original remarks, I have been told sexual favors would allow my bills to go further. The phrasing of that is, it leaves open the possibility, well, first of all, that it was a joke. And second of all, we don't even know if the person who suggested it was requesting it, saying, hey, give me this, I'll give you that, or just offering it as opinion. It could have been another progressive legislator who had said, it's just for all we know, hey, Tanzanator, and that's a nickname she's gotten, I guess, among progressives. Hey, Tanzanator, that's some great legislation there, but the only way you'll get it past the good old boy network is if somebody gets a happy ending. You know, that could have been what generated a phrase like, I have been told. Of course, I want to be clear, Tansy has apparently gone farther. And when the New York Times called her, she did say that it was a male lawmaker who outranked her. And quote, he said that, quote, if I want to see my bills advance, there was one thing I could do to make it happen. It was stated very matter-of-factly that if I would have sex with this person, it would increase the likelihood of my bills passing. So that's what the story is, the latest version of this particular story I've been heard. So I don't know which direction to take here. So the most disconcerting thing I've been finding is how, I don't know, alluring or seductive this social pressure has become. I mean, in local media, it seems to be required by some sort of blood oath to believe Tansy's claim. And on social media, people whose ability to reason I once really respected, they're all falling to the most careless and simplistic reasoning. I mean, circular reasoning. You know, as we have to take every claim at face value, or people with real claims will never come forward, or, and the problem will never be fixed if we don't get everybody hyped up about this. So you're assuming there's a problem, taking any evidence that will supply it, will reinforce that assumption, and then proposing to fix a problem that we don't necessarily know, we can't possibly know exists unless we have the evidence. So this attitude is that we must assume that there's this epidemic that has to be solved and that we all have to turn our attention to this. And this is now a crisis, a pressing issue that we need new policies and new actions and new requirements for how people can act and interact all around something that has never, that in this case that sparked this, is not being affirmed. Now, look, objectively, there are two possibilities that fit the evidence of Teresa Tansey's claims. The first possibility is that some sleazy legislator, and believe me, I know Rhode Island has and has had plenty of them. So some actual sleazy legislator actually made this offer in a kind of one-off way, because Tansey hasn't alleged that it was an ongoing pursuit, which, I don't know. It's not something I've done, but it seems like there'd be this cultivation of your victim, right? That would seem to be the usual mode of operation, and it probably wouldn't even be one. It would be multiple. You know, one thing I've found weird, strange, is that I haven't seen anybody, any interviewer, reporter, ask Tansey how she reacted in that moment or how things were with that person afterwards. So you've got a case where she won't tell you who it was, but you would think interviewers would try to give readers, listeners, viewers some kind of placement, context, narrative, story, some kind of image. You know, how did you react? How did you react when he said that? I mean, you want to, isn't that the first thing you, well, what did you do? You know, if somebody were telling you the story, even just casually, let alone as a journalist trying to get details. So I don't understand why that hasn't been, that emotional connection hasn't been sought. But, and on top of that, by the way, she hasn't been asked to do that. She's telling us that out of the blue, this guy said one thing, and that was apparently it. Never mentioned it again or whatever. I mean, it'd be good and helpful to women to know what she said to make him stop, right? But on top of that, Tanzanator, again, as supporters call her, has never seemed to me to be a quiet person who just wants to get along and who would hold on to this anecdote until some convenient hashtag came out. So that's the first possibility. This actually happened, and for some reason, nobody's asking for details, and she didn't say anything until now. The second possibility is that Representative Tansy joined in on the Me Too social movement on Twitter, not expecting anything really to come of it. It was just something she was expected to do, given her position. And, you know, when the Providence Journal asked, perhaps she, you know, made up something vaguely, or more likely embellished some story from her experience, like the other legislator possibly saying, hey, if you do that, then maybe those guys will give you something, you know, embellished it. And then suddenly she's making national, international news, and the New York Times is calling, and people are calling, contacting her to say, I support you. And this would all create a whole lot of pressure not to back off of the story and to not go, well, you know, maybe I overstated things. That creates a whole lot of pressure. Especially since nobody will ever investigate one way or the other. I mean, including the state police, which is a point she made on Newsmakers, actually recorded today. She said, no, the state police, they didn't even, I spoke to them, and quite frankly, they didn't ask me to name the person, and she has no intention. Well, why wouldn't the police ask her? Is it a support group? Are they investigating crimes? Isn't that their role? Isn't that what we have police for? So she's not going to be found out if she made this, even if she's making this whole thing up, she's not going to be investigated. There'll never be any blowback. And if she were to say, yeah, you know, I kind of embellished a story, that would serve my side of the ideological battle. That would just be an unacceptable outcome from her perspective, I would think. So there's a lot of pressure once you're in that situation, having followed the trail, responding to the pressures and incentives of each moment, not to back off of it. But, you know, just as we shouldn't assume she's making it up. I want to, again, make that very clear. I mean, and we should also never, but similarly, we should never just take every allegation as truth without evidence. When we have, and as in this case, multiple plausible scenarios objectively that you can articulate if you're willing to step out from the peer pressure and the fear of being accused of being a horrible person, which, you know, I am anyway, so I might as well, you know, step out from it. But if you step back from that and you find multiple plausible scenarios, we have a responsibility to suspend our final judgment and not impose new laws and rules, new things on other people until we have some evidence that would lead us to pick one of these paths, something, you know. If she had named the person, even to the state police, which she said she didn't do. If she had at least gone that far, that would reinforce, okay, well, now she's setting up, this is, it's like all the hate crimes we supposedly see, where there's a rope hanging somewhere, it's supposed to look like a noose, or there's something painted on something, or somebody wrote on a chalkboard a racial slur. And often, if you follow these things through, and the follow-up reports, which are much, much less broadly promoted, you find that it was somebody looking for attention, or somebody did something that had nothing to do. Like the rope hanging was from, they had tied some decoration, and then for some reason when they cleaned up, they didn't take the rope, you know, that kind of thing. So we have to at least leave that possibility open until there's some kind of evidence. I mean, she was on, Representative Tansy was on Channel 10 with Bill Rapley, and he said, kind of kind of off the cuff as he closed up, that she hadn't gone to the police and she felt like she had nobody in the building she could talk to. But she did Google and find out that there's a human rights commission that looks into these things. But she didn't say, and I confirmed this with Bill, she didn't say she went to them. She just said it exists. So, and he didn't, it sounds like he didn't even follow up. So couldn't we, I mean, that would be at least one way to confirm. So what's really critical here, I think, is to look at the context that Tansy herself is putting on this story. And for that, I think here's a clip that I think is very telling from Bill Rapley's interview with her on Channel 10.
And she says the culture at the State House is not unusual.
I think that in any male-dominated environment, the prevalence is higher.
Have you spoken to other legislators who have been harassed?
Yeah, in every job I've had similar experiences.
So on this, I'm going to encourage you to pause this or next make a note. And next time you're near a computer, go to the post that this podcast is associated with on the Ocean State Current and click on that video and watch it. Because when she says that, she says that this has been happening in every job she's ever had, she's grinning. Actually, I'll make it the featured post featured image for this post, so that you'll be sure to see it. But so she's smiling while saying that every job she's ever had has had some element of this sort of sexual harassment, sexual objectification. I don't know. Are we allowed to say that seems incongruous? Is that permitted? On WPRI, Channel 12 Newsmakers with Tim White and Ted Nesi, it actually almost got weirder, or not weirder, more confirming of let's say, a skepticism. Because she explains that she doesn't want to identify this person because she doesn't want it to be about an incident. Listen to this.
Your colleague, Representative Brian Newberry, wrote a lengthy Facebook statement reacting to this week's news. And referring to House Democratic leaders, he said, quote, "This cloud over their heads is wholly unfair to them, and if this is not resolved, their reputations may be forever and unfairly tarnished," basically suggesting that there is collateral damage to other high-ranking lawmakers based on the story that you shared with the Journal. What's your take on that argument from your colleague?
I strongly feel that if I make this about one person, then that's all we're talking about, when this is obviously a much broader problem. I think it's a much broader cultural problem that we're looking at.
So that was Ted Nesi asking the question there. So the impression is that Teresa Tansy isn't holding back because she's frightened of repercussions or traumatized. Everybody's been giving her support, from the state police to the Speaker of the House, everybody. She's holding back because she doesn't want this to be about a guy who did something inappropriate. She wants it to be about the assumption that all guys need to be fixed, or at least that all women live in this horrible situation where every job is full of sexual harassment. If that's the case, you know, if that's her perspective, honestly, it really doesn't even matter if there was a guy in a state house, does it? I mean, his identity now is not only, I mean, if it's desirable that he not be named for the purposes of her larger goals, her larger honorable goals, if it's better that he not be named, then it doesn't matter if he existed, right? Theoretically, he could. And if this happens in every workplace, no doubt somebody somewhere has said something like this to somebody, right? And that's how we have to get this conversation started. So first we're told that we can't doubt the truth of her statements, because that would be victimizing her again or preventing the next person from coming forward, which, to the extent that that's true, you know, that would be on the person who won't back up her allegations, who comes forward. And then she tells us that this isn't about an actual crime or indiscretion, but about a political movement. Folks, we just can't take this at face value. That would be irresponsible. And on a broader issue, I mean, look, people can be mean. People say all different sorts of things that belittle and hurt others. I know I've come across it. I've done it, you know, not happily, but I've done it. Maybe happy when you're doing it, but then you realize that you shouldn't have done it and you're not happy about it. But I think we should pause and, reflect on what makes these sorts of claims, specifically the harassment type claims, so egregious that we have to put aside all standards of evidence and tar half the population and agree to all kinds of actions that constrain how we can interact and what we can do with our resources. And it seems like a lot of witch hunting and a lot of running to the wolf's den or the fox's den, whatever animal it was, because we think there's the sky is falling and there's a crisis. That isn't a wise way to behave in a society. And, you know, I'm sorry, but we certainly shouldn't let the Tanzanite use a single vague anecdote as the sole evidence in this crusade to malign our civilization. Having said that, let me move on to free speech, just to affirm my right to have said what I've said. So Charlie Cook, who's the online editor for National Review, took place at Kenyon University. He was the lone voice of three in support of free speech. And this video has gone all over the internet in conservative land, so you might have come across it. But there was one interesting moment that I wanted to highlight here. Stephanie Freiberg, who I take it is the website didn't give very good information about who she is, a professor of some kind, Native American. She had the following to say.
Until we get to a place where we've shifted the culture, we can validate other good ways of being, allow other ways of speaking. So we also don't do that. We regulate free speech such that if I speak like you, I'm rational and non-emotional and all of that is perfectly fine. I also have to learn to speak in a linear form. All of those little features of what you're calling free speech are cultural variables that you're taking for granted that not everybody grows up with.
So the only thing we're disagreeing on here is that you want more Native Americans to enjoy free speech, so do I. But you seem to see it as a zero-sum game, where if more Native Americans enjoy free speech, and to get more Native Americans to enjoy free speech, other people have to enjoy less. And I think that's nonsense. I think that the great sin of American history has been that the blessings of this nation, the promissory note, Martin Luther King called it, not been enjoyed by everybody, and the solution to that is to make sure that they are.
But you are equating free speech and hate speech.
Well, that's because there's no difference, legally or otherwise.
There absolutely there has never is been a difference. Difference.
There has never
one
been
creates a,
difference.
A hostile environment.
It
the
is
other one
subjective.
Is about arguing about points.
Look, I don't like what is commonly called hate speech. Of course I don't. But it is not a term that has any fixed meaning. It's wholly subjective, which is, of course, the entire problem.
So what I find interesting there is the beginning of her, that was after she had talked in a long kind of stream of consciousness way. That was very difficult to find a starting point for my clip there. But she was saying that one of the disadvantages we impose on minorities or people with other being, which I guess means minorities, is that for you to actually claim a platform and have a platform for free speech, we require people to talk like she was to some extent, or Charles Cook, she pointed to him, and talk like you, linear, coherent, coherent thoughts. In order to have a forum like this, you have to have coherent thought in others. And she's ecumenical, I guess, in that respect. She says others like Native Americans, black people, poor white people aren't prepared for that. And so they're inherently silenced because they're not speaking well or linearly. Which that's a very strange argument. Easily dismissed, I would think. Okay, we can only put so many people on the stage. And if we have some perspective, and here's where she's probably objecting, if we have some perspective that there is, we can achieve higher conversations and higher thoughts, then we're going to have to limit who talks. And you're going to want to find people who are going to say something that other people will learn from to achieve that higher point. And sometimes there should definitely be a role, a place for you to go and hear people's other experiences, no matter how well it's articulated, so you can learn about other experiences. That can be fascinating and also great to encourage empathy and being a good person. But that's not, sometimes we also need, and college is supposed to be a forum for a lot of this, some place to go and be taught things that are higher, that pull us, draw us to a higher level of thinking, a different stratosphere. So that's why we would do that. But what's interesting is at the end of that very quote, she's drawing a distinction between speech and hate speech, which one, the speech, which she says she supports, is making arguments, and the hate speech is not. But she's doing exactly what she said was not good, right? If somebody's articulating hate speech in an irrational manner, then you can't assume that they're doing that because they can't think in a linear fashion. And first of all, we should encourage them to want to speak in linear fashion so that we can have higher level conversations and maybe persuade them and show other people where they're wrong. But you can't have it both ways. You can't say, hey, look, if these people are marginalized because they don't speak in a coherent linear fashion like you, you can't then say, and therefore we must marginalize these people who don't speak in a coherent linear fashion like you. One of the people who promoted this, and this is a separate point but related point, who promoted this video was David French, also on National Review. He has a podcast on Ricochet called Liberty Files. And he made an interesting point about when we allow people to, when we allowed government to restrict freedom of speech. And I want to touch on this because I think it makes a very interesting point and advances our understanding of free speech.
What is not illegal under the Constitution are extremely limited restrictions on form.
Right. And, you know, if you're talking about in a free speech, in an area, say, like a college, time, place, and manner restrictions on speech are common. So, for example, I could say in protesting the Iraq War, no blood for oil, but if I'm yelling that at 3 a.m. outside the dorm room of a friend so that they can't sleep or study, that's a time, place, or manner type restriction. It's not a restriction on the, as you said, the viewpoint.
So Charles Cook, with whom French is speaking there, makes a point about how we do allow some restrictions of the form of your speech, how you present your speech. We can restrict that to some limited degree. And French comes in and says, well, there are also time and place restrictions. Those are the three basic ways we can restrict speech. And Cook gives the example of, you know, even if you're saying completely wonderful things like I love puppies and kittens, you can't do it screaming in the hallway in your dorm in the middle of the night. Right, that kind of speech can be restricted, the time and place. The point I want to make here, and I've made similar points before, is that what's really at issue is form, time, and place. These are ways we distinguish whether something is speech or has become an action, right? So if you're the classic crowded theater thing, if you shout out fire and get people to act out of instinct, just they react instantly, or if you're standing in front of a group of people who are seething and you shout charge, you know, to attack somebody, you're expecting an immediate. You're not communicating an idea. You're making a sound that causes a reaction. So form, time, and place in speech, those are ways we can tell where that line is, that you're, when you're libeling somebody, for example, you're trying to do an action. You're trying to make something happen beyond the realm of persuasion and ideas. So I wanted to make that quick note because it's endlessly fascinating. And since I don't have a platform on these stages, I figured, hey, I'll make it on my own platform here as unprivileged as I am. Before I close out, at the beginning, I kind of casually noted that the whole Tansy Me Too episode is minimally important compared to other things. And that comes to with an interesting consequence that I want to explore just a little before I close out. Tansy and a Me Too thing is largely, I would say, a distraction from real news. We've actually heard a lot of people hypothesize that President, especially people who support him, hypothesizing that President Trump is sort of shooting off all these flares to distract the news media and public attention from the things he's actually accomplishing in office. And look, I harbor some skepticism that that's the plan, but it's certainly not unheard of as a concept. Related to Tansy, I've seen on local Facebook, on Facebook, people talking about local news media and implying that they're being kind of snookered into covering this distraction. So I don't know, so that the government can get away with stuff. You know, look, this stuff generates interest, and that's why they run it. I mean, it'd be great if people took more interest in the details of tax policy, debt, election laws, and all that. But they don't. And if the news media used as its sort of guide to what it ran with the stuff that is really objectively more important, all these technical policy details that we really should know about, you know, a large part of their audience would just evaporate. From a civic perspective, obviously, or maybe not obviously, but that might not be a bad thing. You know, let people who are interested be interested. I probably shouldn't have stepped on this at the end of my podcast and when I got to get going and pick up children at school and all that kind of thing. But there are a number of directions I could go with this. So let me just take this in this point as kind of more evidence that people really just want to be able to live their lives. They don't want to have to keep a close eye on every detail of government activity. You know, that, now that I think of it, that might be the reason that socialism keeps coming back into fashion, no matter how many times it proves to be a deadly failure as an idea. People want security and they want freedom. And part of the freedom is to not have to pay attention to the things that don't interest them, even if they provide them with the security. That's a form of freedom. And so a government system that takes care of the details for them and kind of leaves them free, that's attractive. Of course, the problem is that the sorts of people who would be attracted to the power, to being the ones to taking care of the details, they're not going to leave everybody else alone once they've established a small realm of security, you know, rule of law and national security. Once they've got that, that's not the interesting stuff. People who want power want to do more. They want to go out and tell people how to live. And sooner or later, they'll come across something that you do that has to be fixed. That's in making somebody else insecure. Maybe somebody in the audience when you're speaking at a college, right? At the end of it all, the only way to be free not to pay attention is to shrink the government. And the only way we can have security if we do that is when we do it is to base our society within kind of a moral framework that is ultimately voluntary and that you can leave if you're finding that it doesn't suit you and you can leave and try to change it and go somewhere else and try something different. So we need that moral framework and we need a civic structure that has healthy incentives to make it in everybody's interest to make each other secure, whether that's for profit or mutual assistance. And, you know, that's kind of what we had for a while going in America, and we really ought to get back to it. So that's it for this week. As always, if you would like, go on iTunes and find this podcast and rate it and give it stars and go to Ricochet, become a member, and like this post that this podcast is on, and that way the folks at Ricochet will have to pay attention to it, I guess, is how it works. It hasn't happened yet. Also, go to oceanstatecurrent.com and leave comments or email me feedback, whatever you like. And once again, remember, don't worry so much about first impressions because you can always redo those later. Worry about the last impressions because they might follow you for the rest of eternity. In your travels, God bless.